Welcome back, Richard. It's terrific to see you again this morning.
Good morning. Good morning. March Madness. You don't know about March Madness, do you?
I know that there was an upset because it's one of the only the few times that 16 beat first. 16 beat one.
Kentucky and Yale.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so this is March Madness. I'm not a big fan, but I know that it's March Madness because it's much in the news today.
Yes.
But it's toward the we're sliding toward the end of March. Some Christian holidays being celebrated this week and next week.
Yeah.
Easter being a big one. So we're moving toward the end of the month. But anyway, it's good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see
Excited
that.
about I'm excited about today's topic.
I am too, because we've talked just talking about March Madness, which makes you think of college and which makes you think of school and which brings you to the topic of our conversation today. Actually, it's going to be the topic of the conversation for probably the next 3 weeks. Where as we have kind of whittled our way through this topic, it looks as though this is going to be, a 2 or 3 part series where we're going to talk about education and just kind of review a little bit about what's happening in education, because I think it's fair to say, Richard, that we're more than just a little bit concerned about what's happening in our schools.
That's what's producing it. I mean, we have an election year, and so think education is very much on the minds of most people, not just the stakeholders, but sort of everybody is thinking about education these days because it's become a hot political topic. But I'm especially concerned about what all of this news about education, about what the effect that has on our teachers. Because remember, the teachers, they're the ones that we're asking them to educate our children and the next generation of children. It's an incredibly important job. And so I worry a little bit about all this noise about transgender and book bans and school choice. All the I call it noise because it really doesn't have anything to do with education. And so there's all this noise, and I worry about what effect that has on teachers who are trying to accomplish their important tasks.
And we get to this topic because over the past couple of weeks, I know we've been talking about a lot of different things related to education, but we've seen people some videos of people talking about the way that schools are managing student behavior, and we've of course seen lots of talk about those issues that you just mentioned. And the real crux of the problem comes back to what are we asking schools to do? And as you said, one of the big concerns comes down to what are we asking teachers to do? And there seem to be two assumptions, right? Two somewhat erroneous assumptions. And the first is that every class in every school is being taught by a dedicated teacher whose sort of life mission is to educate the future, our future society,
Many people, when they think about schools, they think about them as though it's a factory or it's some kind of a business where you have everything neatly organized. Schools don't work that way. So this idea that every school is sort of the same and every classroom has a teacher and that teacher is dedicated, I do believe that's I keep banging my desk, I'm sorry. There seems to be this erroneous assumption. First of all, in this day and age, presently, not all classes are covered by a teacher.
Richard, we continue to be astonished by the magnitude of the teacher shortage. Like, I don't think that people truly understand what that means. We have school districts that are short by thousands of teachers.
We
It's
already.
it's this is a huge issue.
Right. Florida, in fact, we're going to talk about this as we go through it. Florida has the largest teacher shortage in the nation. We don't, every class is not covered by a teacher, let alone a dedicated teacher. Okay. Not all classes are covered. There are fewer people entering the profession. If you talk to any college in the country, there are fewer people going into education at precisely the time when more people are leaving the profession. And they're leaving it. Many are reaching retirement age. They're baby boomers
Right.
and they're retiring out. Others are discouraged and they're leaving. So we have this, and that's what we were, we thought about titling this. We're borrowing a phrase from an article, A Tragedy of Unimaginable Proportions. And as this teacher shortage grows, it's going to create a crisis, okay? But the second thing is, besides the shortage, is that teachers are also human.
Right.
They get sick. They are tired. They get stressed. They have lives and they get discouraged. And so we have the shortage, but we also know that teachers are getting discouraged by all the noise, by all the anger, by cell phones, by student discipline, by school shootings. And they need our support and our encouragement. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the first assumption, that the erroneous assumption that every classroom in every school is covered by a dedicated teacher. The second one is that while we entrust our children, we entrust our children to teachers and schools every day. We've said this on many podcasts, there's no institution in the country that enjoys the trust and confidence that schools have.
Right.
Well,
Like,
where else?
where else do you put you said this at, when we were meeting the other day, and it's just every time you say it just makes me laugh because it's so bizarre but true that you put your 5-year-old on this large vehicle, a big yellow vehicle with a lot of other kids and a stranger driving it. You
Right.
put your 5-year-old on there and you don't see your 5-year-old again for 8, 8 and a half hours. And do you just believe that your 5-year-old is going to get where he or she is going, that they're going to be somewhere where somebody's going to take care of them, make sure that they're eating, make sure they go to the bathroom when they need to, make sure that all of their needs are met, and then expected them to come back on time, feeling good, in a good mood, and having had a great experiences for the day. And we do that
Yeah,
for
how
5 days
was
a week, 180 days a year.
right? And where else? There's no place else that has that kind of trust.
Right.
And it exists in all 50 states,
Yeah.
okay? So on the one hand, we have this trust, and yet the same teachers that we trust and rely on are increasingly discouraged and demoralized. They are underpaid, they are undervalued, they are being blamed, they're being injured, they're being sued, and they're being suspended. So on the one hand, we talk about the trust that we have and we hand our children over, but on the other hand, we underpay them, we undervalue them. We watch them getting injured. We watch them being disrespected by some students in the classroom. And in a way, we then do everything we can to make teaching as difficult, or maybe we should say impossible, to do. And
Right.
to add insult to injury, we say, and we don't trust you.
Right.
So we trust you with our children, but we don't trust you to do this job.
Right.
Okay. And so we have these two assumptions that of about teacher trust and about a teacher shortage. And people need to understand that the teacher shortage, the looming teacher shortage, could create an enormous crisis. If you think the pandemic was bad,
Right.
this crisis of a teacher shortage is going to make that pale by comparison.
Yeah, because I think that a lot of people look to the pandemic as, well, this is why education is in the state that it's in right now, because the pandemic happened and all the calamity that happened at that time. And sure, there are a lot of people who blame COVID for all of this, but well, one of the things we're going to do in this first podcast of this series is we're going to talk a little bit about how we got here, because it's our contention that the pandemic did not start this problem. This problem started well before the
That's
pandemic,
right.
and the pandemic threw it into the forefront. But this problem has been boiling for a little while now.
Education became one of the boogeymen. It became a boogeyman, but there were others, the healthcare system, the CDC, policymakers. There were all kinds of people who were blamed and damaged when the pandemic struck. And we all remember that, the anger and the disaffection. So, but public schools were just one of the things that got blamed for the problems. But the problems in our educational system didn't begin with COVID. And we can go all the way back. I mean, we could go back as far as you want, but I think for our purposes, if you go back to the 1950s, you begin to see important changes occurring in the educational system. And most of them are all based on good intentions, that we're going to make things better by making these changes.
And I think that as we start getting into this, I think that the important thing to say is something that you have said many times, and that is, for a multitude of reasons, I suppose, schools have been the places where social issues have been resolved or have been addressed, And so you're right, as we go back to the 1950s, we look at Brown versus the Board of Education, and that was all about, much of this all about integration. And so this huge issue of segregation and all of this, the first place we look to address some of that stuff is schools.
Yep, it was decided back in the 50s that segregation is a problem, that we shouldn't have a segregated country. So where do we ask the integration to occur? In our public schools. We didn't integrate neighborhoods. We didn't integrate a lot of things. We integrated the public schools. Okay, that's where it occurred. The good part of that is that it opened a very good education. I think everybody agrees that we had a pretty good educational system in the 1950s. It made that system available for a larger number of kids. Kids who had been kept out of that system, mainly black children, now they were being integrated, they were being brought into that system, and they would have the advantage of this same high quality education that white students had. So we would make education more inclusive. Okay. That was seen as a positive. We were offering this good education to a larger number of citizens. Okay. The second thing that happened in the 50s was Sputnik. And Sputnik, for those of you who don't know, was a beach ball sized satellite that the Soviet Union launched, and they beat us in they got into space before we did. After World War II, there was a called a Cold War between the US and the USSR, and suddenly the Russians were ahead of us. So this scared us. It scared us as a nation and created sort of fear and paranoia. And we hit the panic button and said, "Uh-oh, the Russians are getting ahead of us. We better take decisive action." So where did we take that action? With the educational system. And a year later, Sputnik was launched in 57. And a year later, the federal government developed something called the National Defense Education Act. This was 1958. And millions of dollars were poured into all areas of education. And you can go back, and this is when preschool education, kindergarten, all that stuff really developed from preschool through graduate school, all prospered from this money that came flowing into university. This is when universities and schools built buildings. Campuses were relatively small until NDEA, and then there was this massive growth. So both of those occurred. So we see this expansion and improvement and inclusion of larger and larger numbers of students. So that lasted through the 50s and 60s.
And then as we get into the 70s, then we have, Public Law 94-142, which ended up, evolving into Individuals with Disability Education Act later on. The Public Law 94-142 will basically said, there are a lot of students who need to be educated. In fact, we're saying that all students need to be educated from really from birth through So many of you may not know this, but the public school system is responsible for kids up until their 22nd birthday.
Right.
And so, so Public Law 94-142 and then eventually IDEA says, regardless of your disability, regardless of your strengths or weaknesses or whatever, you should be afforded a free and public free and appropriate education. And so this is where we start getting like IEPs or exceptional student education.
Right.
And this defined what we mean by students with disabilities and how to keep those students in their local schools instead of sending them off to
That's
other
a church
schools
place,
or
right?
right. We're keeping them in our public schools, and the national government is affording additional funding to be
Right.
able to keep those students in schools and educated.
Right. And so from the 1950s through the 1970s, what we see basically is an infusion of money to improve education, especially in math and science, because we want to get ahead of the Russians, but also to include more students in the
Right.
education, students of color, students who had been in poverty, students with handicapping conditions. So the effort in those first 25, 30, 40 years after World War II was to make the system better and bring more people into the system. Then in the 1980s, it seems like this takes sort of a cynical, almost sinister turn in the 1980s, because until that time, the United States enjoyed this privileged position. We were one of the few countries that didn't get damaged during World War II. So our factories were still up and running and producing things, and we were building highways, and we were building buildings, and building factories, and building cars. And we were one of the few nations in the world that could do that because the others had been destroyed. Europe was in ruins, Japan was in ruins, and every other nation was rebuilding from the war. We weren't touched by that war. But over that 30 or 40 year post-war period, other nations began to rebuild and began to catch up. And suddenly, policymakers in Washington, D.C. became very concerned that other nations were passing us. And one of the reasons they said they were passing us was because of our educational system. So once again, the bright lights are shown onto the educational system. And there was a little pamphlet, a pamphlet, 40-some page book published called A Nation at Risk. And the subtitle is The Imperative for Educational Reform. We have to do something, okay? And when you read this book, it's kind of scary. Now we're talking about 1983, so that was what, 40 years ago? Yeah, 40 years ago. Yeah. So it's a generation ago. And they said what this book said was, and it wasn't just a book, it was the official government publication from that administration. And it said that our nation is being damaged by a mediocre educational system, and that other countries are matching and surpassing us. And the country that was doing this was Japan. I remember very clearly they said, Japan is way ahead of us. They're doing things that we don't do, and their students are smarter than our students. And then they added that if an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose such a mediocre educational system, we would consider it an act of war. Well, when you start this, when you put it that way, you say, okay, we got to do something about this. I remember, I clearly remember because I was in education at the time, that it was this scare that other countries were getting ahead of us. The sinister part of this is that the message was that educators are failing us, that the teachers, the principals, the professors, the people actually doing the teachers were blamed for this. Okay. And this is a fundamental change that we need to understand. We blamed the educators, so therefore, we have to somehow fix the problem from the top. We have to get, I don't know who these people were. Were they smarter? Were they more knowledgeable? Were they more experienced? Somebody needs to take over and make them do it right.
Right.
Okay. And this ushers in the era of the 1990s.
Right. And the shift that happens here is that it goes from, let's pour more resources into the schools to make them better and make
Right.
all of the schools better. That was the goal, was to make all of the schools better because we wanted all of the population to have the same education, to be, to be built up. And what we start to shift now is now we're on a hunt for those teachers or those schools or those places who aren't meeting the cut. They're not doing what they need to be doing. And so, we start now blaming teachers for things not for the decline or what is seen as us not measuring up to the other countries. And so it is a very interesting shift that happens because it becomes a very different perspective of how do we fix the problem. It
Right.
went from let's put in more resources to let's figure out who's causing the problem. Let's figure out who's not meeting the cut and blame them, and then do something about that.
Right. It would be like taking over a corporation and saying, okay, where can we save money? Who's doing a good job? Who isn't doing a good job? So we sort of had this top-down management of schools. And for the first time in our history, we have now other people other than educators. Prior to this, the government gave us money and it was up to the educators to spend it and do a good job with it. Now, all of a sudden, if we define teachers as the problem, then teachers have to be shepherded, they have to be supervised, they have to be held accountable for what they're doing. And so now for the first time, you feel this top-down pressure on the entire profession, whether it's preschool or universities, you feel this pressure coming from the top that you have to do things a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's the educational reform that started in the 1990s and is very much with us today. And that's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about what effect that has had on teachers who are trying to do their work in all these classrooms.
Right. Because if you think about that difference between, those earlier years that we were talking about where money was poured into the system at all levels, now money is available. But you have to prove yourself worthy first. You have to
Right.
prove yourself worthy
Right.
being able to get additional funding or resources. And so, because it was around this time in the 90s and then in the early 2000s and everything, where all of a sudden schools started to get graded. We started
Right.
to see that schools would earn a grade based upon student performance. It would get graded as an A through F, just like students do. We started seeing high stakes testing. We started seeing that teachers would get paid based upon the performance of their students
Right,
instead
right.
of, what they were, the time spent and the work that they put into teaching their students. It was now based upon this grade or this score that students earned on a test.
That's right. And I want to go back to a point we made earlier where one of those erroneous assumptions was that all schools are the same.
Right.
Now, everybody knows that all schools are not the same. No, anywhere in the United States, there are high performing schools and there are low performing schools. And we also know that the high performing schools typically are in wealthy areas and low performing schools are in poor areas. Okay. So every school is not equal. But what happened with this change in the 1990s is that we were going to start to grade schools. That was one of the foundations of Governor Jeb Bush was governor then, and he developed what was called the A plus plan. And there were several components of that. One of them was we're going to grade schools based on the performance of students on standardized tests. Guess which kids are going to do better on standardized tests? The kids from wealthy, high-performing schools in wealthy neighborhoods. That's just the way this works. Also, requiring students to meet grade standards before they got promoted. I remember this. We all remember this. that we said, if students aren't reading at grade level by third grade, we're going to retain them. Well, suddenly
Right.
that created a demographic nightmare for schools because you had too many third grades and not enough fourth grades. Okay,
Right.
so catastrophe. Okay.
And that all happened, that all came about in around 2000 with the No
Right.
Child Left Behind.
That's right. Then it happened at a national level.
Right.
It wasn't just Florida. This was happening in every state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember at that time, you know, people halfway, half jokingly, I think that there was a kernel of real concern in there that, you know, that we would need to start putting parking lots. I don't know if you remember people talking about this, putting parking lots in middle schools, because if a student was retained twice because of failing the third grade reading test, they're going to be driving in middle school. They're going to be, they'd be 16 by the time they're in middle school, while they're in middle school. So it became very concerning because, you know, on the ground level, everyone sort of knew that that was an impossible feat.
Right.
Like there's no way that all third graders will read at a third grade level.
Nope.
I mean, statistically, it's impossible.
Right.
But that's what the rule was, and that's what we set as the expectation. And so we started seeing not just students being experiencing negative consequences to it, but schools and teachers and everyone else were experiencing negative consequences for it. And schools started losing funding.
Right. Yeah. And the idea, teachers were, you pay teachers more if their students do better on the test. Well, it's going to be the best students in the best schools are going to do well. So the teachers who have the best, highest achieving students will get more money. So the idea was, we're going to give more money to the high performing schools. We're not going to give it to the low performing schools. Again, we say this probably was a good intention. I'm thinking that people were sitting around in a room saying, I know how we can solve the problem. Let's do this. So I don't question people's motives, but all of these intended reforms, most of them have fallen flat. They didn't accomplish. And one of the other components of the A plus plan in Florida was to add more charter schools and vouchers and online schools and homeschools so that parents would have a choice. We would give parents a choice. Instead of having to go to your neighborhood school, we would give you a choice to have your child go to another school. Well, we're going to talk about that, this idea of choice, because it's very much in our thinking today. We're going to talk about this at some length later on.
Yeah.
But you see what happens here is that we have this mentality of somebody needs to take over the education system because the education system is failing. All right. And so we have to impose limits. We have to impose rewards and punishments on teachers because we can't trust them to do it on their own.
Right.
We have to force them to do it or reward them for doing it. And
Right.
so the entire world of educational reform changes from let's fund programs that make schools better. Let's encourage educators. Let's give them the resources that they need. I think through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the thinking was, let's give educators the resources they need to do a better job. In the 1980s, it shifts to let's insist on accountability and let's make educators do things a certain way, or we will restrict or we will limit their funding.
Right.
A huge change.
It is a huge change. And if it might sound familiar to some of you who are listening, that is a real life example of a token economy. And just as we have said, a token economy doesn't work when you're managing children. Token economy doesn't work when you're managing a system, certainly a system as large as education, but it doesn't work when you are attempting to use it with, you know, in real life situations with money and performance and all of that. It just doesn't, it's not sustainable and it doesn't work. And so we have seen this experiment since the 1980s just fall apart. And, you know, as you said, we're, you know, in the next in the next episode, we're going to get into this idea of school choice and what's happened since we have implemented these magnet and charter and all these specialized schools. You know, does that mean for education, and what has that led to? With that, I think that that's it for this podcast.
Yeah, right. No, that's good. It's a good start. Stay tuned for parts two and three.
Absolutely. So until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.